Hello, Linda Mottram here. Welcome to PM. Uproar in Washington as a new book has former White House Chief Strategist Steve Bannon levelling this accusation against the president's son over a meeting with a Russian lawyer.
Treasonous. That's going to change the narrative. If Steve Bannon hasn't spoken to Robert Mueller, the special counsel who's been charged by the Justice Department to look into this matter, I suspect he might get a phone call in the coming days.
More urgently here at home, though, what future for 1,400 South Australian abattoir workers in limbo after a fire at their factory? And our ancestors lived short lives, right? Well, we're going to debunk that. Stay with me. This is PM. Explosive, a bombshell, unprecedented, choose your adjective. For the dramatic and some predict terminal falling out between US President Donald Trump and his former chief strategist Steve Bannon, which this evening has seen Mr. Trump slap a cease and desist order on his former confidant, reports say. It's over Steve Bannon's claim in a soon-to-be-published book by author Michael Wolfe that the president's son and son-in-law were treasonous and unpatriotic for taking a now famous meeting with a Russian lawyer prior to the 2016 presidential election. That was the meeting where they were promised dirt on Hillary Clinton. Responding, a furious President Trump released a statement reading in part,
"Steve Bannon has nothing to do with me or my presidency. When he was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind."
And targeting Steve Bannon's reputation as a major leaker before he was pushed out of the White House 8 months ago, 8 months into the Trump administration.
"He spent his time at the White House leaking false information to the media to make himself seem far more important than he was. It is the only thing he does well."
A big falling out, though. In his first non-Twitter comments on his radio show, Steve Bannon has now told a caller that the president is a great man and that he supports him day in and day out. Well, Ron Christie was special assistant to President George W. Bush and is now a political analyst in Washington, D.C. We spoke earlier.
Linda, first of all, thank you. It's a pleasure to join you. And for those of us who look at American politics and observe the White House and the political characters in Washington, D.C., this is entirely unprecedented. There's a new book coming out in the States the next week that looks at the Trump White House in the first year. And Steve Bannon, my instincts tell me, felt slighted by something that maybe President Trump or one of his sons or his daughter or someone in the Trump inner circle had said about Bannon. And how did Bannon respond? By going to the author of this new book and having very salacious comments about the president's daughter, about Donald Trump Jr., and about the Russian collusion probe.
Okay, the president has hit back pretty quickly as well, so he's obviously taking it seriously. The president must be fuming about this.
The president must be fuming about this, and let me put this in a little bit of context. When I worked for President George W. Bush, there were aides, low level, who came out with books, and they had their tell-all, and they trashed the president, and they let the media really run wild with it. And what was President Bush's response? Nothing. He refused to dignify the remarks. He refused to dignify the substance in the book. And here you have the president of the United States in a very, very personal, very pointed manner earlier today take Steve Bannon down, say that when Bannon was fired that not only did he lose his job, but he lost his mind. My concern is that that's not very presidential on the part of Mr. Trump. If he wants to really let Bannon stew in the mess that he created, if I were Donald Trump, I wouldn't have said a thing. Mr. Trump's commenting on this only gives more fuel to the fire, more ammunition to his critics, and of course will lead to more book sales when this book comes out next week.
Always the book sales. So yes. What are the practical implications, though? I mean, what's the material impact? For example, around the quotes about the nature of the meeting with the Russians, the now famous meeting that's been so well worked over, and of course we have the Mueller investigation as well around matters to do with Russians. But you know, Bannon says in this book, you know, that meeting was treasonous. Does that change anything materially?
I think it changes the dynamic of how the media in the United States and around the world will cover this. Trump has repeatedly said, there's nothing here, there's no collusion, this is all about fake news. And now you have the chief strategist from his campaign, who got him elected to office, his chief strategist within the White House, who worked with Mr. Trump for the first 8 months, now saying that the contacts with the Russians were treasonous. That's going to change the narrative. If Steve Bannon hasn't spoken to Robert Mueller, the special counsel, the lawyer who's been charged by the Justice Department to look into this matter, if he hasn't spoken to him now, I suspect he might get a phone call from the Justice Department in the coming days. Mr. Trump thought that the Russian investigation was going to go away sooner rather than later. I see this, Linda, as dragging out month after month, probably well through the 2018 midterm elections that we're going to have here in the United States later this year.
What is the Republican Party going to make of this?
The people I've spoken to on Capitol Hill today are flummoxed. We have a budget that we need to pass to keep the government open without having a government shutdown. We have a immigration opportunity to build a wall that President Trump wants and to allow certain undocumented children who came to the United States, brought here by their parents, to pass. And yet all the wheels of action have grounded to a halt on Capitol Hill as everyone in the town, Republican and Democrat, looks to the White House and says, what's going to happen next and what other shoe could drop next? I believe, Linda, we haven't heard the last from Steve Bannon. Earlier this evening, he responded to the president's tweet and said he's not sure who lost whose mind. Donald Trump's not going to take that lying down.
Ron Christie, thank you very much for your time today.
A pleasure to join you. Thank you.
Republican political analyst Ron Christie, who was special assistant to President George W. Bush. Here at home, companies growing and producing cannabis in Australia are relieved about new rules announced by the federal government allowing them to export medicinal products. They say it'll save their industry. Exports will start from next month, and the companies are banking on Australia's reputation for quality in agriculture and biotech to enhance their competitive edge internationally. Our political reporter in Canberra, Melissa Clark, joined me a short time ago. Sounds like the government's hoping for two wins in one here, a win for Australian patients and one for the industry. Is this a bit more than political hype?
Well, certainly the market seems to think so. Shares for cannabis producing companies here in Australia have gone up quite significantly on this news. So investors clearly believe that this is a wise move. And the companies themselves say that is the case, that the current market for just serving the domestic patients that are being prescribed these medicinal products isn't big enough for them to be sustainable, and that the industry wouldn't have been able to continue with just the few hundred patients that are currently using the products in Australia. So the federal government allowing them to export from next month onwards, they say, will be a big boon. The health minister, Greg Hunt, is certainly promoting the idea that this industry will go on to be quite a significant one for Australia in terms of export earnings. That's what he was saying when he was out promoting this morning.
We have a world-class reputation for our clean and green farm products. Put them all together, and we are brilliantly placed to be a world leader in medical development and medical cannabis.
Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt. I wonder, Melissa, if there's room now for more players or if those existing companies have it sewn up already.
Well, this is an interesting question because it is such a brand new market. Medicinal cannabis was only legalised in 2016. And because few doctors have actually been prescribing medicinal products, there's only been around 300 patients using it. And even the big companies, the ones that got in first, have found they haven't been viable to continue on unless they were to get a bigger market. So one of those companies is called the Can Group. They were the first to get a research license and then the first to get a license to cultivate cannabis following the legalising of medicinal cannabis in Australia. And they say they weren't going to be able to continue just serving a domestic audience, and they were really hoping this move would come through. I spoke to their CEO, Peter Kroc, and he told me that effectively this was a make or break issue even for the leaders in the market here in Australia, big companies like theirs.
That was always going to be a question mark as to how long it would take the Australian market to develop. And you would have heard today Minister Hunt has referred to 300 patients in Australia. There's no industry that can set up to service 300 patients. So exports allowing us to set up at scale and then ensuring we have product available for Australian patients is our first focus. But being able to produce enough product to be competitive on a global scale and being able to export that product means that we can now develop on a much faster time frame.
There are other countries that have had legalised medicinal cannabis and in some cases recreational cannabis use and have established markets. How will Australian companies like yours go about competing against those markets that are more developed already?
We think that the medicinal cannabis market is not going to be a global commodity that we're competing with. We have the opportunity, particularly with the capability in Australia around medical technology, to move this to a different level. And by having a focus solely on medicinal cannabis and not being distracted with mass production of recreational products, that's where we have an opportunity to set this in a different direction.
Do you have a sense of just how much value this could bring to Australian companies like yours?
We aren't putting numbers against it at this stage, but what we do know is that growth in medicinal cannabis is significant, and it is moving quickly in a number of different jurisdictions. So Canada has been at the forefront of this, but you look at Germany came online in the last 12 months and they have already put cannabis, medicinal cannabis, on the equivalent of their PBS. So, and we're seeing it move in other European countries. So I think that's where we will see the market continue to grow around the world.
The market certainly seems to be backing this move. Your share price has gone up quite substantially. So clearly investors believe that there's a lot of potential here.
They do. And I think it's important that we now make the most of that. As of the 15th of this month, we'll have raised roughly $78 million that allows us to really push hard. And we're looking at and are in discussions on a couple of key sites that we're looking at already that will allow us to build state-of-the-art cultivation facility, but also at its core, a GMP manufacturing hub that will allow us to produce products that obviously will be done under TGA guidelines and guidance. So this will be world-class product that we can have available for Australian patients.
The CEO of cannabis producer Can Group, Peter Kroc, with our political reporter Melissa Clark. One of Australia's largest meat processors is desperately trying to redeploy 1,400 workers after a massive fire that destroyed its abattoir east of Adelaide overnight. The abattoir is owned by Thomas Foods International and takes beef, sheep and goats from thousands of farmers nationwide. All the workers and the animals escaped safely, but it is a blow to the industry and, of course, to the workers. A short time ago, the abattoir's owner, Darren Thomas, spoke to reporters.
My most important thing when I got the phone call was that there was no injuries. As I said, the business almost takes a second stage to that because I want to make sure that our employees, their welfare. And I said, my main focus will be over the ensuing months is to ensure that as many of our people are gainfully employed in whatever format that may be.
South Australian abattoir owner Darren Thomas. Our reporter Marty McCarthy is following this story in Adelaide. Marty, tell us what happened at the abattoir.
Well, the fire started accidentally. It happened during maintenance work last night, and it's in a building 100 metres long and four storeys high. So that gives you a bit of an idea of as to how big the flames got. Murray Bridge, though, with its population of 16,000 people, has been understandably rocked by this accident. It's effectively put 10% of the town temporarily out of work. So counselling support is now being provided to staff, and financial support hasn't been ruled out at this stage either. But at this stage, there are still a lot of unknowns for a lot of the workers there.
This will have national implications for the meat industry, won't it?
Yes, it will. Thomas Foods International, it sources livestock from really all over the country, even as far as Western Australia, and that's from thousands of farmers as well. So 70% of its product is even exported, so there might even be some impact internationally. But for that reason, because it's exported, it's not expected this event will have a major impact on lamb and beef prices for consumers here in Australia, as some have expected in the media today. But as for farmers and workers and the owners as well, things still aren't quite so clear. Social media lit up with vision of flames four stories high.
Cars everywhere. People all over the joint come to see what's going on.
The inferno took 100 firefighters 12 hours to get under control. Darren Thomas, the chief executive of Thomas Foods International, was on holiday with his family when he got the call from emergency services. He rushed back to Murray Bridge, east of Adelaide, to see his family business burning.
And I've literally seen 20 years of my life almost evaporated before my eyes.
Fire authorities have revealed the blaze was sparked by a maintenance worker who was welding a bin.
No, look, by its terminology itself, it's an accident. As I said, this is a family business and, you know, I've made plenty of mistakes in my life and accidents.
TFI has grown rapidly in the 3 decades since it was established and has sites at Tamworth in New South Wales and Wollongarra in Queensland, along with its SA operations. It is Australian-owned, exports to 80 countries, and has an annual turnover of more than $1 billion. Its lamb, beef, mutton and goat production supplies major supermarkets in Australia, Asia and the United States, and it supplies the McDonald's chain. Brenton Lewis, the mayor of Murray Bridge, says the fire will have major financial ramifications.
They are an extremely large player for the state's economy, certainly our economy, the state's economy and nationally. I mean, Thomas Foods now are positioned in other states of Australia. I'm of the opinion, knowing the family, that they'll recover from this as fast as is humanly possible.
The Murray Bridge factory is one of the biggest abattoirs in the country, killing 50,000 lambs a week and 5,000 head of cattle. Adrian Pederick, member for the state seat of Hammond, says the fire will affect farmers nationwide.
Oh, well, look, this is a major food processor. They process 1,000 cattle a day and 11,000 sheep a day, and those are big numbers in anyone's language, and they do draw stock from not just the state but across the country. There is going to be some short to medium term pain, but there needs to be assessment. No one's been able to get in apart from emergency service personnel.
Lamb producer Alex McGorman sends 800 lambs to the TFI site at Murray Bridge a week. But he's optimistic. He says the high lamb price will help many producers ride out delays in processing.
Probably the shining light for us farmers, farmers statewide, nationally, is that we're at record levels. If this affects our prices of lambs because there's loss of kill space, I believe farmers, we can ride it out for a short term. It's probably the best time for it to happen.
The price of trade lambs increased by more than $1 per kilogram over the past 12 months. So farmers have some cash to fall back on.
The farmers aren't going to be hurting as much as the workers.
Jamie Marshall from the Australasian Meat Industry Employees Union says they're trying to do all they can to support the workers.
Most of them are just concerned about what's going to go on with ongoing work and ongoing payments and how they're going to pay their mortgages and keep their family fed.
Jamie Marshall from Australasian Meat Industry Employees Union. Marty McCarthy, our reporter. This is PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tell your friends about the ABC Listen app because I know you've already downloaded it. It's a great place to listen to us. And stay with us on the program this evening. Why do holidaymakers on cruise ships keep getting gastro? It's happened again on a ship across the Tasman. Stay with me and you'll hear some more from those who were on board. Iran has been in turmoil all week, but is it now all over, as Iranian authorities claim? Some 450 anti-government protest figures have been arrested and apparent confessions have been aired from some of those on state TV. But the deep economic grievances that fueled the uprisings by tens of thousands in 24 Iranian cities remain utterly unchanged. Earlier, I asked Hooman Majid, an Iranian-American journalist and author based in New York City, whether the protests have really ended.
Well, we don't have evidence that they're ended, and I'm not sure that they'll ever end. I mean, the truth of the matter is that there have been protests ongoing in Iran way before this latest round, which turned violent. Various kinds of protests, like protests of people outside banks demanding the banks to pay them back the money that they've lost in various schemes, or people looking for their wages and stuff like that. Not on the scale that we've seen in the last week. But no, I think that the main point that the Iranian government is trying to make is that they believe that there are certain instigators of this violence and of this latest round. They have rounded up something like 400 or 500 people and put them in prison. And actually, I saw that today they actually had aired some confessions on state TV, which are never obviously reliable. But I think they believe that they've at least got a control of the demonstrations and the protests. But I think that you're going to see these kinds of things pop up from time to time as long as Iran is in a, you know, problematic economic situation, which it is.
We've seen counter protests as well reported overnight supporting the government. There are many Iranians who don't support the anti-government protesters. So how genuine are these counter protests?
Well, I think they're genuine to a certain degree. There's a number of ways of looking at it. One is that the regime has pretty widespread support overall among the very, you know, faithful, the loyalists, and what that widespread translates to 20%, 30%. It's still a significant number of Iranians who support the system, who support having this system, having an Islamic Republic. But beyond that, there's also quite a large group of people who don't want to see Iran descend into a Syria or descend into a Libya. And that's something that concerns and scares many reformists, ordinary Iranians, which is why I think you don't see too many people joining these protests. I mean, the numbers are actually quite small as compared to 2009, which was prior to the Arab Spring.
Now, the US president has been egging on the protesters and condemning the authorities in Iran. He's got a big decision to make soon, though, and that is whether to continue the waiver of sanctions that are part of the nuclear deal. Just explain to us where that is at.
Well, where it's at is he has reluctantly waived those sanctions, I guess, three times now since he's been president. And he was supposed to certify every 3 months that the Iranians are complying with the nuclear deal, which the IAEA, which is the UN agency responsible for knowing whether the Iranians are, with inspectors on the ground, has always said they are complying with the deal. But President Trump in October decided not to certify that Iran is complying with the deal. That left it up to Congress to decide whether they, 60 days for the United States Congress to decide whether they wanted to reimpose the sanctions. They chose not to do that. Now we're at a situation where in mid-January, there's two decisions to make. He once again has to certify whether Iran is complying with the nuclear deal, which is highly unlikely he will do that, given that he already didn't do that in October. And then he also has to waive the sanctions to be not in violation, for the U.S. to not be in violation of the nuclear deal. Because as long as Iran is complying with the deal, according to all the participants and the U.N. agency, the United States has to waive nuclear-related sanctions, the unilateral sanctions that the U.S. put on Iran on the basis of its nuclear activity. If he decides that he won't waive those sanctions, then the U.S. is in violation of the nuclear deal. Then it becomes a big question what Iran does, what the Europeans do, what China and Russia do. It's very hard to say at this point.
Hooman Majd is a close watcher of Iranian politics on the line from New York earlier. If you suffer from seasickness, your stomach might just turn at the thought of this next story. Sorry. Up to 200 passengers have had to be quarantined on board a cruise liner because of a major gastro outbreak. It's at least the fourth mass gastro outbreak on cruise liners in Australia over the past year. The Sea Princess has docked in Brisbane, where the ship is being cleaned and passengers treated for symptoms of the illness. George Roberts reports.
Recovering at Brisbane's cruise terminal, Leon Wallace was one of the dozens of passengers quarantined for gastro.
I guess it's the nature of it. So many people trapped on board a confined vessel.
Another passenger says he's getting used to seeing gastro outbreaks at sea.
Almost every cruise I've been on, there have been cases of norovirus. Sometimes it's been bad, sometimes it's only been a few cases. But the trouble is that it spreads so easily, you've only got to get one person infected.
Last year, the Sea Princess's sister ship, the Sun Princess, had 90 people struck by the virus on a trip to Papua New Guinea, and then 140 people fell sick on its next voyage to New Zealand. That's despite disinfecting the ship between cruises. Professor Charles Jilks is the head of the University of Queensland School of Public Health.
Gastroenteritis is usually caused by either bacteria or viruses, in the same way that, you know, sore throat can be caused by either bacteria or viruses. And it's an important distinction because viruses can be spread much, much more rapidly within closed communities.
In a statement, a spokesman for the Queensland Health Unit dealing with the outbreak confirmed norovirus was found to be the cause. Professor Jilks again.
The norovirus is particularly nasty in these situations because it has an extremely low inoculum or number of virus particles which need to be ingested to cause an infection. It can be as low as 5 to 10 virus particles alone.
Symptoms usually include nausea, vomiting, diarrhea and stomach cramps. Some people experience fever, chills and aches. Professor Jilks says an outbreak could start from one passenger who is infected but not showing any symptoms.
And hundreds of people in a closed environment like a ship can get infected very, very quickly.
How long can the virus live outside the body, say on a surface or, you know, in a container or food or something like that?
So that's all very different. I mean, the virus, if it's dried and it's hot, will die relatively quickly. But if it's in a bit of vomit that's lying around or it's on somebody's hands, which are moist, that the virus can stay infectious for several hours.
Is there a problem with cruise ships not adequately preventing against this kind of thing?
As regards cruise ships, I think this is a common problem globally. I think this company's been rather unlucky because I believe they've put in, after the second problem they had, they put in really fairly stringent precautions to try and get on top of these. And that includes careful examination of what is taken on board in terms of the food and the water, trying to screen out symptomatic crew members and trying to make sure that the passengers who come on board are all healthy. But, you know, it's very, very difficult to keep this out.
Given the picture you've painted, would you ever go on a cruise?
Oh, yes, but I'd wash my hands. And I would be very, very careful when I use communal facilities to make sure that that they were wiped down carefully.
Very, very careful. The wise words of the University of Queensland's Professor Charles Jilks, ending George Roberts' report. And Princess Cruises have not replied to our request for comment. Brutish and short, Hobbes said life would be outside of society. And that's how we tend to think of the lives of our ancestors, isn't it? But is it right that people, say in the Middle Ages, didn't live past their 40s? Well, that's been debunked. ANU archaeologist Christine Cave examined the teeth of people buried in British cemeteries between 475 and 625 AD. She told Peter Lloyd what she found.
I always get asked, how old is old? And people are surprised when I say, you know, 70 or 80 years old. Well, what I did was, as I'm examining Anglo-Saxon individuals, I travelled to England and looked at the skeletal remains of three cemeteries worth of individuals.
Were you surprised by what you found?
Not really, no, because even though the general belief has been that no one lived to an old age in the past, I mean, historical documents, you know, from, say, Roman times, ancient Greeks and things have told us that there were always some people who lived to what we'd call a grand old age.
How do they live to a grand old age? I mean, not everyone did. So what made these people different? Is it they were wealthy or they ate better?
Especially in a very basic society that, you know, without any outside resources, wealth can be useful because they'd get first pick of the food and that. But often it's really just luck. Genetics, you know, luck that you don't get killed in a battle or fall off your horse, luck that you don't get a disease. A little bit like today, really.
Does this suggest a great failure of modern medicine then? There hasn't been that much of an advance from what you're arguing.
Yeah.
We haven't really come that far forward in 2,000 years.
Well, we've come forward because so many more people live to these old ages. Whereas, you know, it might have been less than 10% of the population lived past 65. Now, it's a very large proportion. I can't give you the figures.
So is the fact here, though, that what you've identified is some people lived past 40, but many people still did not?
Well, quite a few didn't, but a lot more lived past 40 than is believed.
Is this research myth-busting, good stuff for dinner parties, or is there something more we can do with this information?
I think it's certainly good stuff for dinner parties and myth-busting, but I think there's more. I mean, if we want to understand the past, and, you know, a lot of research is done to understand the past, for reasons of understanding the present and the future. But if we want to truly understand these past societies, we need to be able to identify all the individuals who lived in it. not just the, you know, sexy warriors, the pretty princesses, you know, the wealthy, the whatever. We need to be able to look at the old, the poor, you know, the women, the children, and see the whole society, not just the fashionable ones.
ANU archaeologist Christine Cave with a fashionable and youthful Peter Lloyd. That's PM for tonight. Thank you for your company. Hope you join us again tomorrow. Have a great evening.